Tomorrow, the aroma, imaginary or otherwise, is Wiener Schnitzel and sauerkraut. As German heritage, Wisconsin style comes to Eau Claire. I looked it up, and I think I'm supposed to say Empfang?
Empfang, oui, that's good.
Welcome to Spectrum West.
Thank you.
First of all, I think because they are one of the sponsors and it's the big institution, tell us about the Friends of the Max Kade Institute.
The Max Kade Institute, which has actually several, let's say, permutations across the nation, one in New York City, one in Indianapolis, one in Lawrence, Kansas.
Okay.
This one being in Madison, works rather independently in Madison. It's attached to the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And it devotes its energies to the study of the, let's say, German history in the United States, in this particular case in Wisconsin. That includes the immigration history to Wisconsin, which, after all, is one of the most German of the United States, and about all the heritage that the Germans left in Wisconsin, that is, beyond beer, bratwurst, and sauerkraut.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
We talk about institutions, public, private institutions. We talk about private business. We're talking about education, the political life, and so forth.
I always heard that the Germans who arrived chose Wisconsin because it reminded them of Germany.
That is very true.
Geographically.
They believed Wisconsin resembled a lot in its topography already. The German landscape, especially southern Germany with its hilly, low mountain ranges, it provided a lot of water supply. The river system was considered very important. It also provided good soil. And most of all, it was easily to be attained or reached via the lakes. The Great Lakes at the time.
Oh, sure.
It was before the railroads took over. So the Germans believed Wisconsin to really look very much like Germany. Little did they know that the climate was, however, markedly different in many aspects. For example, the summers were much hotter than in Germany. The winters were colder and longer. Spring very short, long falls, and so on. And the Germans didn't really realize this until they were here, to the point that one settler who had built his cabin with a very loose roof in the summer found himself one October morning waking up in his bed with a foot of snow on his blanket.
Well, being hardy people, they stuck it out, though. They've made quite a footprint.
Well, one might say it was almost a process of self-selection. In that already, just to make the decision to leave home, to uproot all your social ties, to burn all the bridges, to cut off everything, took a lot, because home for the Germans at that time, as for most other people in the world, meant really being intricately interwoven with your social structure around you in a village, for example, with a church, with your profession, the artisans and the farmers and so on, the land, very important. So it took a lot of energy already to extricate yourself from that environment, be it for political or economical reasons. And then to also survive the voyage all the way first to the port city in Europe, that is maybe Le Havre or Rotterdam or Bremen or Hamburg, whatever, then travel in steerage across the Atlantic, then arriving in New York, running the gauntlet of New York City before finally finding a boat up the Hudson River, let's say, then follow the Erie Canal to Buffalo, and then finally Great Lakes to Sheboygan before Milwaukee arose. All that, those trials and tribulations, of course, only the hardiest were able to survive. So in other words, once they reached the woods of Wisconsin, the intractable woods of Wisconsin at the time, they probably were the few ones who actually could then muster the energy to build up an existence and to carve out a
There was no going back.
There was no going back. Re-immigration or re-migration, as it is called, among Germans of that particular period was very rare because, as you just mentioned, it's well-nigh impossible.
Yeah.
Also, even if you managed to travel back to Germany, to reintegrate yourself into the German system after burning all the bridges would have been difficult.
The annual meeting in Eau Claire tomorrow is of that institute we mentioned for German-American Studies that's based in Wisconsin at UW-Madison. Interestingly, we've been focused lately on the contemporary arrivals and immigration reform here in America, that except for festivals, we don't think much about the extent of German heritage or any heritage in Wisconsin. So meetings like this, I think, are important. Are they designed to revive the German spirit a bit?
I think it's not so much the pietophilial or whatever brand that we'd like to promote, but we would like to raise consciousness, not just in the sense that, yes, the Germans shaped Wisconsin to a large extent, which is true, has been forgotten by many people, some also accept it without, never really thinking about it. But we really would like to use this as an example for migration that is happening more now than it ever did in the past. Although we talk about millions and millions of Germans leaving their country in the 19th century, now we're looking at millions and millions of people traveling back and forth, whether voluntary or forced, to their future, and whether it's the Somalis or the Latin Americans or Chinese or Japanese or Koreans coming to our shores. I think they're facing similar issues to some extent. Of course, we live in a 250 years later in a more modern world with more technology, especially the transportation system has changed radically. Mm-hmm. But sometimes the basic life questions that these immigrants face have not changed. And that is the question of, shall we call it integration? Shall we call it co-social adaptation? Sure. Because the immigrant, it's not just the immigrants who have to adjust to a host culture. It's the host culture, of course, also that absorbs cultural traits from the immigrants.
It would be a shame if a young lad or lass whose family name was Schmidt or Schneider or Mueller did not ever understand or come to appreciate the heritage that brought that name to their signature.
And that is very interesting that you mentioned that, because when the immigrants first came in the 19th century, they tried to preserve their language and their culture. Sometimes they lived in insular situations like New Holstein or Kiel or even in Milwaukee, which was a very German city at the time, with a third of its population being either first or second generation Germans. But it is interesting that normally children of immigrants try to get more readily integrated into the, in this case, Anglo-Saxon host culture, whereas then the grandchildren often begin to think about their past and about their grandparents. And sometimes you find closer affiliations between grandchildren and grandparents when it comes to the cultural heritage than between children and parents. We see a kind of resurgence of interest in genealogy, but not only in the sense of family history, but also the general circumstances that brought those people's families over to these shores. Mm-hmm. And that is a question that I think is especially germane to the United States experience, because we are, after all, a country of immigrants with very few exceptions, unless you say that the Native Americans also immigrated at some point across the Alaska land bridge.
Interesting you would bring that up. I had that wonderful relationship with grandparents and great-grandparents because I remember, and you and I talked before we started recording, that my grandparents on the maternal side lived in New Holstein. Mm-hmm. Or you should say Holstein, I guess.
You're right.
If you were being correct. And I remember my great-grandmother talking in German to her neighbors.
Yes.
And I also remember that whenever we would show up on the front porch, my grandfather would say, "Wie geht's?" to my father.
Yes.
I always thought that was kind of cool. I appreciated that link. And I, at this point in my life, am a little sad that maybe that link is dwindling.
Well, I think that's why I encourage younger people, also our students, to really ask their grandparents, ask many questions as long as there is still opportunity. Because obviously the history always is things past, and we can only find out about this history by talking to the representatives of that past, and those are our grandparents and even, if possible, great-grandparents.
And I always wanted them to sit down and record things. In some cases, that didn't happen.
Yeah. That's exactly the work that some of my colleagues have done at UW-Madison by recording Germans, and they call them also the different Englishes that's being spoken in the state and the different German dialects, because we must not conflate all the German dialects into one language. Those were people who came from various corners, whether it was the German Empire or the state system with sovereign states before 1871. Those people hardly understood each other. A Bavarian encountering somebody from Schleswig-Holstein would probably not have understood the other person, and not to mention about the cultural differences and also sometimes hostilities between those different ethnic groups, sub-ethnic groups, as we might call them.
We're enjoying a conversation with Johannes Stroschenk. I can't get the old part. He's a professor of German at UW-Eau Claire. German history in Wisconsin is the topic because the Max Kade Institute for German-American Studies annual meeting is in Eau Claire tomorrow, Saturday, May 4th. I have a schedule of events that includes the Chippewa Valley Museum, the McIntyre Library, And I see that you are going to be a busy person from about 10 in the morning till about 2 in the afternoon.
Well, it starts with a workshop for those people who have some idea of German, because I'd like to introduce to them the German writing, handwriting style of the 19th century, which is rather hard to read. It's a very kind of edgy, scraggly, or actually quite beautiful handwriting that was introduced by the Germans in the beginning of the 19th century and continued all the way through, let's say, World War II about. And many young people, most Germans actually, cannot read that handwriting any longer. Its name is Sütterlin, because it was invented by a Mr. Sütterlin. And lots of historic documents are written in that script. And that's why I'd like to introduce people to that script and teach them about it.
I saw on television this past weekend they had an original copy of the Gutenberg Bible. Is that what you're that same kind of thing?
No, that was actually more Latin looking.
Oh, okay.
And it was before actually the German nationalism arose, introducing own typeface for printing, which is called Fraktur, and as I mentioned, the handwriting Sütterlin.
All right. Central and West Wisconsin has a healthy population of Amish and Mennonites. They not only live an unadulterated life, they also speak a German dialect. They will also be part of a presentation to your group as well.
Right? My colleague Josh Brown will be giving a talk on the Mennonites, particularly of Clark County, which is adjoining Eau Claire County.
Sure.
And actually, I don't know much about the Mennonites, and I'm looking forward to that talk, actually, to learn from him. I know a little bit more about the Amish, and I know that the Amish and the Mennonites and other Anabaptist groups, of course, originated from Southwest Germany and Switzerland, also Alsace. So I look forward to that talk.
This event is open to the public, but I understand there was a registration deadline. If I'm a person listening to this conversation and I simply have to check it out, can I still do that?
You just walk into the event and put your name down at the registration and tell the people what you would like to attend, and you pay accordingly.
Okay.
But you are always welcome.
So now what about the food aspect? There's going to be some, isn't there?
Yeah, it will be a German dinner being served at the university in the library. It will be Rouladen, with Spätzle and Blaukraut, I believe.
Sure.
And a dessert. So, and actually, Leinenkugel has agreed to donate a keg.
There's a good German name. Huh? What does Leinenkugel mean?
Oh, I even don't know. I never thought about that. Leinen is linen. And Kugel, it may have been a linen weaver or linen maker whose tool maybe have been a spheric kind of thing in order to shape maybe spheric shapes for dresses for linen. I have no idea. But that would be my guess.
When I was naming those names like, you know, Mueller and Schneider and Schultz and Schmidt, I should have brought up Kuchenbecker, because there's a good German. I had a good friend whose name was Kuchenbecker.
Yeah,
he said it was Cake Baker.
Absolutely
right, yes.
Mm-hmm.
How cool is that?
That's wonderful. Many, many German names, of course, hail back to their actual professions of the ancestors.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for being with us. And you know what? I think I'm going to have you on as a guest again, because in the time allotted this week, we can't delve into it nearly as far as I'd love to. And please accept our invitation to do that again.
Thank you very much. I certainly will keep that in mind.